Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
This is NPR News. I'm Tiffany Hansen in for Carrie Miller. And now we're in depth on the nature of societal change and the questions we ought all be asking. There's technology in our lives today that we never could have imagined just two decades ago. I paid for dinner last night by holding my cell phone up to the cash register. Our identities and our communities, both online and IRL, have changed dramatically as a result. If you follow that dotted line forward from here, you have to wonder, how will societies adapt? How will our demands on government change? Will we someday want to vote on our phones? According to my next guest, we're at a point in history right now that is so transformative that we can't rest on what we know or what we think we know. The mindset of, if it worked before, it'll work again, just isn't good enough. We have an obligation, he says, to push beyond, to ask questions, tough questions. Failing to do so, he contends, will result in a vision deficit so wide that none of us will want to be around for the large corrective heave it will take to right our societal ship. It will be ugly. Of the scary characters that Hollywood churns out, zombies, snakes on a plane, sharknadoes, reconstituted dinosaurs, he says the dinosaurs we should truly fear are politicians, the lemmings at think tanks, and economists. They're the ones failing to evolve and adapt to change, and their failure to ask the right questions is going to land us in a world of trouble. David Rothkopf is the author of The Great Questions of Tomorrow, and he's CEO and editor of Foreign Policy. He joins me from Washington. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
So you start the book with historical analysis of where we are right now. Your comparison is to draw a line between the 14th century and our current era. Why globally do you see comparisons between the 14th century pre-Renaissance era and today?
Well, I think, you know, if you looked at the 14th century, you might think it was all about the bubonic plague or the Great Schism or the Little Ice Age or some of the bad things that were happening in the 14th century. And if you focused on those things, you would miss the fact that slowly but surely middle class was rising and slowly but surely there was a sort of rebirth of scholarship and that you were actually in the first days of what we would later come to see as the Renaissance. And so, you know, it's possible sometimes to be so caught up in the headlines that you miss the bigger picture. You miss the bigger societal transformations. And for the past 20 years in the United States, almost 20 years, we've been focused heavily on terrorism. We've been focused heavily on a very limited threat from a very limited number of people. We're focused on our daily headlines, the drama in Washington, the follies of the Trump administration. And we're not seeing that within 10 years, we're very likely to see a change that's as big as the Renaissance was, one that literally changes the way society works at every level.
Well, you mentioned politicians first in your list there that I brought up, politicians, the lemmings at think tanks and economists. So we'll start there, I suppose. You say they're the ones who are essentially the most calcified by the status quo. You say they capitalize on the fears of the moment to advance their self-interest and desire to cling to power, and that it regularly keeps our eyes on yesterday's headlines. Clinging to yesterday is a pretty safe place to be. It's sort of natural for us to want to stick with what we know. Why is that so wrong in a lot of ways? The example I think of is one that you mention in the book about you're walking through the woods, you get killed by a bear, you don't walk that way anymore.
Yeah, that's adaptation. But the bear is delighted when people continue to walk that way in the woods. Some of the people that we're talking about here are people who are sort of akin to the bear. They've made their they've made you know, the system their prey. They've benefited from it, and they'd like to keep the system just the way that it is. And we live in an era of political leaders who are really reactionaries. They're really trying to cling to the past, whether it's Donald Trump's fantasy that he could turn back the clock to the 1980s or Bibi Netanyahu's fantasy that he can turn back the clock to the 1960s, or Vladimir Putin's fantasy that he can turn us back into the Soviet Union. These guys got to power, they made their money, they've made their reputations in a different kind of environment, and change isn't good for them. But for the billions of people who are out of the money, for the billions of people who haven't had an opportunity yet, and for those who recognize that technological change is producing changes in our systems of belief and the way that we operate here on this earth that require deeper adjustments, clinging to the past is precisely the wrong formula and is, in fact, one that's likely to make lives for many worse and cause us to miss what's really going on.
Don't we really have ourselves to blame? Haven't we created a system that supports this type of leadership pipeline?
Well, all systems of power are designed to serve those who are powerful. That's the problem. The problem is that they therefore become lagging indicators. But there are other elements to our society, other systems within our society. And so scientists and technologists are looking forward and producing devices and breakthroughs that produce change. And thinkers and philosophers are trying to understand what the implications of the advent of those devices will be. And they become advocates for change. And people who don't benefit from the society look for ways to benefit, and they become entrepreneurs, and they become activists who seek change. And so politics is just a slice of it, and there are other things that are whirling around that tend to propel us forward.
Well, to that point then, to stay in the politics realm for a second, we can't then necessarily say that all politicians or all leaders fall into the camp you're talking about, because there are politicians that aren't necessarily stuck on the status quo. You have to admit that there are political leaders, they might necessarily be in power at this moment, that aren't stuck in the status quo, that aren't saying we need to go back to 1956. They just may not have been the ones that were elected in this last go around, right?
Of course. The point of the book isn't actually to dwell on the shortcomings of politicians. I've written other books that dwell on the shortcomings of politicians and on the strengths of some politicians. The point of the book is to say, let's not get too hung up in today's headlines when something really big is coming down the pike and we need to prepare for it.
Right. And so the point is to ask these questions. And your first one is the basic question, who am I? That's a huge question. Aren't we really asking for trouble by asking such a broad, big question? It seems like there's millions and millions of answers to that question.
Billions, possibly.
But
I think, when we come to these great watersheds in history, we really need to go back to core questions. Because the order of society has changed. And when the order of society changes, things like the social contract, things like the way we organize ourselves as a civilization end up either being changed inadvertently or being changed as a result of some thought. And I think changing it as a result of some thought makes sense. And that leads us back to these sort of core questions which underpin the social contract. And when you say, who am I? I'm not saying, do you want to be a writer or do you want to build motorcycles? What I'm saying is that much of our identity for much of history has been derived by geographically driven factors, by the people around us. You say, who am I? And you say, I'm from Minnesota, or I'm from St. Paul, or I'm from this family or this village. And a lot of our identity comes from that. But we're moving into an era in which geography defines less and less of our identity, where by connecting to people and to others in the internet, we can more easily find people with whom we share affinities who are far, far away than we may even in our own communities. And that changes how we identify ourselves. So you might not say, I'm from Minnesota. You might, if you're in a particularly dark place, say, I'm a radical Islamic extremist and I want to be part of ISIS, and I can see them online and I want to connect to them online and be part of that community. There's also positive analogs too.
How does the answer to that question propel us forward? How does the who am I question propel us forward as a society?
Well, I think implicit in your question is an old definition of what is a society. Which society are you talking about? Who am I is the fundamental question that you ask when you say, I say I'm entering into a social contract. With whom? For what purpose? Mm-hmm. In what direction are we heading? And you might find, if geography is less of a driver of the answer to that question, that geographically organized systems of governance are less important. And there's a lot of talk now about, you know, are nation states going to, you know, survive the next 100 years, or are they a phenomenon that started back in the, you know, the Reformation and the 30 Years' War that had their time, and that some kind of global mechanisms may make more sense?
I'm talking with David Rothkopf, author and editor of Foreign Policy, about his new book, The Great Questions of Tomorrow. I'm Tiffany Hansen in for Carrie Miller. I would really like to get you in on the conversation as well. What questions do you think we really need to be asking ourselves as we stare headlong into our rapidly changing, increasingly globalized future? You can tweet me at Tiffany Hansen. That's Hansen with two S's, E-N. David, that question, who am I? We know it, and it feeds into the societal question. That question of society has been changed radically by social media, by technology in the last decades. Our sense of community has been radically altered. How does that change the who am I question?
Well, it follows from what I was just saying. And of course, if your sense of community has changed, not only does it change your identity, but of course, we're shaped by those around us. Some ways positively, some ways negatively, where they help us grow, they help limit us. You talk about social media, and one of the things we've seen is that if we use our circle of friends as the filter for the news that we get, and most people under 50 get their news from the internet, and most people under 30 get their news via social media, then that group of people actually shapes our worldview, shapes our perception of what's a fact and not a fact. And that's different from the way things worked in the past. It's a more extreme version of the way things worked in the past. And it changes the nature of political discourse in ways that we've seen very clearly recently, not just in the United States, but in European elections and in countries around the world.
Yeah, I think that technology, by my lights, has allowed for a distillation of the self in a lot of ways. In other words, people go online and they become more of a, for better or worse, a certain piece of their personality. Do you agree with that? And if so, how does that affect this kind of cultural shift that we see on social media?
You know, I think almost every technological development that we look at tends to be not just sort of double-sided, but starkly double-sided. So, you know, the internet is a major force for democratization. It empowers people. It gives them more information. But it also concentrates a lot of power in the hands of the few, and it also gives new tools to people who are would-be autocrats. And I think the same is true with regard to the self. You know, it may enable you to drill down and obsess and connect with people who are like yourselves and limit yourself. But of course, it also opens up doors. And I think, you know, one of the things that we should think about is the biggest change that's going to happen in the world in 2017 has nothing to do with Donald Trump. It has nothing to do with Vladimir Putin. The biggest change that's going to happen in the world this year is that hundreds of millions of people who are not on the internet are going to get a smartphone and an internet connection, and they are all of a sudden going to be connected to the planet for the very first time, able to see everything that happens everywhere else, reach out and touch anyone anywhere else at any time. And that's happening every year. And that is an opening up. It's not just a narrowing down.
One of the other things you talk about that is sort of an opening and expanding of our perception of what our future can be, not just in terms of the way people can be connected and will be connected with one another in terms of, you know, this cellular connection that we see happening in the world. But you talk a lot about artificial intelligence and what that might mean for us in the future. And I think some of that language that you use there can be very scary for people. And I wonder if that has something to do when people ponder what our future might look like, when they ask these questions of themselves, and it seems a little scary, isn't it more comforting to then just revert back to the known, to the past, to what might feel comforting?
Well, first of all, you're the one who brought up Sharknado earlier. If you're trying to come up with scary imagery, but I think the advent of artificial intelligence is not something that we can forestall. You know, one of the guys I talk about in the book, Nick Bostrom, a philosopher, works with artificial intelligence scientists. He went out and he talked to essentially the core of that community and asked, when are we going to actually have artificial intelligence as a major factor in our lives? And some said 2030, some said 2040, some said 2050. None said 100 years. None said never. It's around the corner. And so we have to figure out, you know, how are we going to deal with this? Because we tend to use technological innovations. And we also have to ask, you know, what are the implications? What does it mean if you can have a machine write a poem? Or what does it mean if you can have a machine, a smart machine, guide a weapon and determine who lives and who dies? Or what does it mean if we can attribute characteristics that once were only attributed to human beings to a machine, and then you turn off the machine? What is the consequence? What are the legal responsibilities? How does it change society? Whose jobs are replaced? What happens to those people? What becomes the nature of work if a machine cannot just do repetitive tasks better than human beings, but can do creative tasks or tasks requiring sensitivity or behavioral analysis better than a human being?
One of those researchers that you talk about says, in thinking about the future, a future in which artificial intelligence surpasses and possibly stands in place of our own. Before that day comes, he contends, we need to teach artificial intelligence to adapt to our values. I wonder if that assumes, of course, that we all have shared values.
It does. And that's, you know, that's really, you know, kind of one of the core bright line issues in all of this, because it's not just, you know, that some people have good values and some people have bad values, but the nuances between our values are very different. And in Western society, we value individualism, and in Asian society, we tend to value community more. In some societies, we tend to defer to authority. In other societies, we tend to challenge authority. In some societies, we want people to fit in. In other societies, we really want them to be creative and be different. And people will be using new technologies to achieve and advance those goals and to perpetuate those values. I'll give you another sort of small example of it. What if the bots that you encounter on Twitter and elsewhere in social media were smart bots? What if the debate that was going on was increasingly taken over by smart bots that you couldn't tell whether the person you're engaging with is a bot or a person? How does that change political discourse? Who, you know, if somebody has access to kind of technology that allows them to flood the debate and shape it to their values with these kind of smart bots, what kind of dystopian world will we end up in then?
Well, and what will it do to the character of our civilization, which is another question you ask. You say, how does technology change our own character or that of our civilization? And I was wondering, how can you, first of all, it's extremely hard to judge my own character, let alone the character of my civilization.
Well, it's always been true. You know, it's an inexact science. But what we try to do is we try to come up with rules and guidelines that ensure that we live together as well as possible and with technology as well as possible. And it's changed over time. You know, it took 350 years to get from Gutenberg and the first printing press to the First Amendment. But somewhere in that period, we saw abuses of power by governments and restrictions of speech and all, and we said, no, that can't go on. And so we set into law that kind of guideline. Now, you know, there are 9 countries in the world or 10 countries in the world today that guarantee people a right to the internet in their constitutions, because they've come to the conclusion that without access to the internet, you can't be a full citizen, you can't get a job, you can't be educated, you can't take full advantage of society. Well, that's the beginning of a new set of rules. And I think part of the question that we have to ask ourselves is, what kind of rules do we set for artificial intelligence? What kind of rules do we set for a world more heavily dependent on the internet? What kind of rules do we set for a society where affinities cross borders? What kind of models do we set up when our understanding of economics and the role of government change very profoundly?
Well, you're talking about affinities crossing borders. Might we even be looking at a society where affinities will no longer cross borders? If we might have a society where we have more of a cultural homogenization that occurs that is maybe borderless, it's all online. Do we need to be posing those sorts of questions also? That there's this sort of new cultural homogenization that technology is going to force upon us.
Well, sure. I mean, that's kind of, in one way, the core debate of the last presidential election in the United States and the backlash against Europe and the, you know, United Europe in the EU. And that's the debate against globalization. There's some people who say globalization homogenizes and destroys our national culture and changes our identity and undermines our traditions. And other people say it opens us up, makes us more tolerant, enriches our lives by exposing us to a variety of new stimuli and experiences and thoughts. And, of course, both are right, right? You know, mm-hmm. Again, this is a double-edged sword. And what we have to decide is, how do we want to handle that? Do we want to close our borders down, or do we want to open them up? If we open them up, how do we preserve what we want to preserve while gaining what we can take from this new opening? So we're still roiling with these issues.
Well, we're living with contradiction, essentially. And it seems like we were, as you said before, we're living in an age of contradiction, which we sort of have to admit and we might have to live with for quite some time.
That's right. And what I'm saying is, it's not a question of whether artificial intelligence comes or not. It's coming. Do we want to set rules for it now, or do we want something to happen later that's a problem? It's not a question of whether we're moving towards an era of cyber war where countries can be attacking them constantly all the time, even in peacetime. Do we sort of let that happen until something catastrophic happens, or do we try to come up with doctrines and rules that rein that in? It's not a question that we're going to move away from paper money and jobs as we know it. But should we have a debate and a discussion and brainstorm about what the best possible outcome there is and guide it in that direction? Or should we run up against a wall in a crisis each time before we start discussing what it is we really seek? And obviously, I think the latter is a mistake.
Well, are we presupposing that we can get to some sort of utopia at the end of this? If we ask ourselves all of the right questions, that eventually we're going to get to some sort of utopia at the end?
Well, no. I mean, you know, I mean, that certainly isn't the case. But on the other hand, you know, the arc of history does bend towards progress. And, you know, we live longer now. We are healthier. We are better educated. Jobs are less taxing. There are fewer wars. Fewer people die in armed conflict. Medicine is better. People have access to more solutions to more problems. More people are better educated. Literacy is higher everywhere. The world, despite the headlines, is a much better place than it's ever been. And these technological changes open the door to better possibilities. The problem is that big periods of transition also bring big disruptions. And so the Renaissance and the Reformation brought about the 30 Years' War, which was the bloodiest war the world had ever known. The Industrial Revolution brought about World War I and World War II, the bloodiest wars the world had ever known. And the question for us is, do we learn how to do these transitions better based on our experience with past transitions, or not?
Well, the people that were living through those periods were living through them, dealing with their lives in the same way that we are. And I think that as you're living through those periods, it's very difficult to kind of step back, step out of it and ask yourselves these questions. Don't we have to cut ourselves a little slack, essentially?
Look, I'm not judging you. You know,
okay,
I'm not judging everybody out there for not doing it. But, you know, Along the way, John Locke cropped up and came up with some basic ideas about the rights of man, and Rousseau and Hobbes came along, and Jefferson and Hamilton had some vigorous debates about the shape of society, and Albert Einstein explored what could come of atomic energy and started posing some big questions about how we should use atomic energy. Throughout history, great minds have grappled with philosophical problems at the same time as embracing and dealing with changes and living their daily lives. And I just don't see much of that reflective philosophical debate right now. And I do see some real efforts to quash what leads to that debate, including an acknowledgement of facts, an acknowledgement of reality. I mean, think about it. It's 2017. There were marches on behalf of science. People felt that they had an obligation to go out in the street and say, facts matter too. Facts are important. Things that are really happening need to be acknowledged. And I think that's what's at the core of this. There are a group of people who benefit from our inattention to the changes that are coming and from our lack of seeking an education that is required to understand those changes, and from a lack of debate about the philosophical changes that are going to be necessary to adapt to them. And we need to say to ourselves, no, I'm going to take some agency here. I'm going to play a role. I'm going to grapple with some of these philosophical questions. I'm going to bring my friends into it. I'm going to guide my political leaders in that direction.
I'm talking with David Rothkopf, editor, CEO of Foreign Policy, about his new book, The Great Questions of Tomorrow. I'm Tiffany Hansen, and for Carrie Miller, I would really like to get you in on this conversation here with me. What are the great questions you think we need to be asking ourselves, considering as we lurch forward into our technological future globally, culturally? Tweet me at Tiffany Hansen. That's Hansen with two S's, E-N. As we talk about technology, David, we can't help but talk about data and big data, which is something you touch on as well. According to Pew, young people generally don't want the government collecting their data. We know this. But they don't really mind if big companies collect their data. In other words, they're happy to be sold some stuff. They don't necessarily want Big Brother. But we know that as the future marches forward, big data is going to be monetized, we think, probably in some way. Data is going to have a bigger influence on how economies move, how societies move, between how we move. Talk to me about big data.
Well, I mean, there's several issues associated with them. One are the issues of privacy you talked about, and even in the past couple of weeks, you've had the United States Congress removing kind of some of the protections that we've had to enable corporations to get at that data and to monetize it. Personally, I think someday we're going to look back on those early days of Google where we greedily said, oh, yes, free email. That's wonderful. I'll take that in exchange for giving you access to all my data. And we're going to say that is a kind of bargain akin to, you know, buying Manhattan Island from the Indians for $24 worth of beads, because free email is very low value. Giving people all the data about who we are, what our interests are, what we're buying, what we're looking at any given moment is very, very high value in this environment. And I also think that it's a big mistake to suggest that companies are somehow more benign forces or lesser forces than governments. Facebook's plan is to have 5 billion members by the year 2030. That would make it the largest organization of people on the planet Earth ever by a lot. And what are they going to do with that data? And what happens when a government comes to them? Do they give the data to the government? Do they cooperate with the government? Is there some kind of collusion where, in exchange for profiting from the data, the companies are happy to give the government the data that's necessary to keep society in line or keep certain groups in power? These are not abstract theoretical questions. But big data poses other kinds of interesting questions. So, for example, right now, you know, we manage our economy based on sort of two sets of things, monetary information and fiscal information. And most of the data we have is old, and most of it's inaccurate, and most of it's based on algorithms with just a few variables. But we're moving into a world where Visa and MasterCard, American Express, and a lot of other companies know exactly what most of the people in society are doing economically at any given moment. And we could go from managing a national economy with crude national tools to micro economic interventions, from macroeconomics to nanoeconomics, where we're looking at a block and we're saying, I see how the correlations work there. I can manage that economy, or I can create stimuli for that economy, and on and on. I think someday we'll look back on this era of economics and see it as kind of the Jurassic era of economics, where we, you know, the big innovations that really helped us understand the complexities of the interactions of millions and billions of people didn't come until later in this century.
Well, in fact, economists are one of the people you sort of say are the dinosaurs here, right? They're acting on these GDP, labor statistics, unemployment rates. That these are all, you know, statistics that are essentially not doing us any good, as that we're evaluating our economy based on these statistics that aren't really helping us much.
It's crude. It's like medicine. It's like a doctor, you know, evaluating your heartbeat, you know, with a stethoscope, and then coming up with a diagnosis for some, you know, complex problem in your microbiome. They're just not the right tools. There's a mismatch. And in fact, you know, when GDP was invented in the 1930s by a bunch of economists in the U.S. Commerce Department, they said, don't use this as the principal measure of the U.S. economy. And we kind of treated that like one of those tags that's on a mattress, you know, where we sort of said, oh, well, thanks very much. And they ripped that off and they proceeded to use this idea exactly as they wanted to. And we know it's wrong. We know it doesn't reflect economic growth. It's you know, most of this stuff is a black box, even for the economists.
So should we do what Bhutan is doing, gross domestic happiness?
Well, you know, I mean, Bhutan and the French government and Joe Stiglitz in the United States, a Nobel Prize winning economist, and others have said, let's come up with a better metric. And I think it's a good idea, because we don't actually live in society with the objective of producing wealth. We live in a society with the objective of producing better lives, happier people, more security, lots of things that aren't actually reflected in GDP. And to come up with a kind of one, you know, unidimensional metric by which we judge our success or failure as a society is a big mistake. And coming up with one that's very wealth-oriented naturally leads us to do things that foster the creation of wealth, which benefits a few, rather than fostering the things which benefit the many.
You quote Einstein in the book, when searching for solutions, devote your attention to finding the right question. If you do, the best answer is sure to follow. I want to ask you one last question. Are you hopeful?
I'm very hopeful about the long-term future, because, as we said before, progress is a constant throughout history. And in fact, I don't think you can actually be a rigorous student of history and watch it as the number of wars decline and violent deaths go down and lives get longer and people get better educated and quality of life goes up and wealth goes up and all those things happen, and not say, I'm fundamentally an optimist. I think being a realist requires you to be an optimist. But I do think we have to be aware of some of the hiccups and disruptions and sometimes catastrophes that come along the way with that progress. And so long-term, very optimistic. Short-term, quite cautious.
David Rothkopf is CEO and editor at Foreign Policy and the author of the new book, The Great Questions of Tomorrow. Thanks so much for joining me today, David.
Been my pleasure.
Programming supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, dedicated to promoting informed and engaged communities, and committed to helping public radio advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.